Legally Blonde, Suits, My Cousin Vinny.
All badass lawyers, all different.
Which begs the question, what type of lawyer do you want to be?
Don't waste another second thinking, ugh, I don't even know what types of lawyers there are.
Trust us, we've been there.
Let's put a stop to that once and for all.
Go take the 90-second quiz from New Lawyer Now What coach Angela Vorpal to give yourself a clear picture of the best fit type law for you.
Go to www.whattypeoflawyerquiz.com and take the quiz today.
Once you've taken the quiz, send us a DM on Instagram to let us know what type of lawyer you got. We can't wait to hear. Hi, guys, and welcome back to the Ladies Who Law podcast. I'm Sam.
And I'm Haley.
And this week, we have a guest that we are very excited to introduce to you guys. Her name is Carol Murchison, and she is a litigator. But not only is she a litigator, she is an advocate for victims of abuse from religious institutions and cults and a bunch of stuff like that, that we'll get into more detail in the episode. But a while ago, we had been talking on the podcast, and I had asked you guys, like, hey, if you guys know someone who would, knows about cults, essentially, let me know. And one of our listeners reached out. They had been in a cult themselves, and that's how they knew of this amazing attorney. So we reached out and we're so happy to have her on today. And yeah, we can't wait to see what you guys think.
Let's dive in.
Please help us welcome our guest, Carol Murchison. Hi, Carol. How are you?
I'm well. How are you this morning?
We are doing great, but we're excited to have you on today. And let's just start. Why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself?
Well, let's see. What are the important things about myself? Well, probably for the purposes of your podcast, I'm a lawyer. I've had a circuitous route to the law and through the law. So I started law school much later than most people do, in my 40s. And then I retired early from the law, and now I'm back litigating, a thing that I never thought that I would do again. So that's just a little bit about myself. And I'm in Mexico right now. I live in Mexico part of the year. So I dangle that out as a hope to all of you that that lawing for years, that you get to do some pretty fun things.
Well, I'm sure you are keeping warm in Mexico right now.
Actually, it's raining in Mexico right now, which is very unusual, but it's not snow, which I understand much of the United States has.
Yes, yes, that is so true.
10 degrees outside. Okay, so let's go back to law school, but you said that you started law school later in life. So yes. What were you doing before that?
Yes. Well, so I had a degree. I think I was probably my last job before law school is I was an administrator at the University of Colorado at a program that they had called the Economics Institute. And, I worked in a series of administrative jobs like that. And at a certain point, I realized that the thing that I was doing didn't have a name. You know, like I wasn't a doctor or an engineer or, you know, or a lawyer. And so I thought about, actually, you know what it is? I'm now remembering this. My husband said to me on my 40th birthday, what do you want to do with the rest of your life? And I said, oh, well, I want to be a lawyer. And I said, I always wanted to be a lawyer, but, you know, I can't do that now. And he said, well, you know, why not? I said, well, I have to take the LSATs and I have to go to law school, a pretty important part of the whole process. And he said, well, you know, the time is going to pass anyway. So I did. I studied for the LSATs. We were living in Colorado. We moved to Boston so that I could go to Northeastern Law School. Nice. Where I felt, you know, they have an internship program. So they have a slightly different model than other law schools. You go the whole first year, but then you either go to work for 3 months or you go back to law school. You don't have the summer off. And so it's a quarter system. So a quarter on, a quarter working. I felt like at 40, I knew how to work.
Yeah.
And that probably would be a better thing for me. And it was. It was a very positive experience. And so I ended up in Boston. I started practicing law at a kind of a regional, large regional law firm. And I didn't like litigation. So maybe many of your listeners will resonate with that. It was a lot of conflict. Mm-hmm. I felt that it was conflict with, I was in a pretty large law firm, so your own partners, you know, the people that you work with, the people on the other side, your own clients, the judge, you know, there was just an endless stream of people that I felt that I was in conflict with, and I didn't like it. And an opportunity arose. This is back in the 90s now, 1996, 97. The Supreme Court decided a duo of cases, Farragher and Ellerth. And they said, I was in employment law. And they said, if you have a policy and you try to prevent discrimination and all of these things, you get an affirmative defense. And so I moved my practice into the area of training and investigations, more of a consulting role with the clients that I was working with, which were all kind of, they were all corporations, businesses, that kind of thing. So that's how I got into the law. On a whim almost, you know, on somebody saying to me, what do you want to do? And thinking, you know, I really have wanted to be a lawyer. I knew I couldn't be a doctor because I hated science and blood. And I thought, well, I can talk. And so probably I can learn to be a lawyer.
So when you got to law school, did you find that a lot of your peers were younger, or was it kind of a mix, or how was that, you know, dynamic?
It's an interesting one for sure. I was certainly among the older students, but at Northeastern, there were quite a few students who had other life experiences. And so I found it challenging. I'm sure everyone finds law school challenging. Is there anybody who's been on your podcast who has said, just law school was really a breeze for me?
If they did, they might have not been telling the truth. I mean, I just don't know anyone personally who would say that, you know?
Yes, right. Because it's hard, isn't it? Yes. It's hard psychologically. It's hard intellectually. It's hard in a lot of ways. I found it hard because I hadn't been in school for a long time. So the whole dynamic of being in a class, and then law school classes are famously very different from other kinds of classes.
Yes.
I found that Northeastern was really the right place for me because it wasn't so competitive as I understand that other law schools are. I thought that it was more hospitable to being a woman, to being an older woman. And so I think just the whole system of law school is a difficult one. And of course, intellectually, it's quite challenging. And then to make things like even harder, you find out, as I think one of your guests said, really, you didn't learn anything in law school about practicing law. then you had to get out and be in that very long, what I think of as stressful learning curve.
Yes.
Yeah, that's where we're at right now in our careers, right out of, you know, a year out of law school in the thick of
things. Oh, yes.
I don't know what I'm doing.
Yes. Well, if I don't know whether this is any comfort, but I'm in my, I don't even want to count years of being in the law, and I'm back to practicing law, and I'm back to litigation, and I don't know what I'm doing either. And so a lawyer once told me it takes 15 years to become a good lawyer. And, you know, at the time I thought, I don't like this well enough to spend 15 years at it. And so I moved my practice into really what was, I would say, running a business within a law firm. So I was doing training, which was operated as a business. I had trainers that were different from the lawyers who practice law. And we did a lot of very large projects. And that was much more satisfying to me. But, you know, if we're lucky, we change.
Yes.
You know, mm-hmm. we become stronger. Things that bothered us when we were in our 20s don't bother us when we were in our 40s. And so I think the law offers a lot of opportunity to do things that are a fit for you, which you don't find that out in law school.
No.
I mean, I never thought about whether the law was going to be a fit for me because I had no idea other than what I saw on Law and Order on television, what lawyers actually did, you know. And so it's a difficult profession. I think we should be honest about that. It's difficult, but rewarding. It can Absolutely. Be very rewarding, right?
So let's talk about after law school and working at the firm and mm-hmm. how you said there was so much conflict. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that it was even at the firm. You know, can mm-hmm. you talk about what it was like working at a law firm, being an associate and being, you know, probably 43 years old at that point, right?
Older than some of the partners.
Yeah. So what is that dynamic?
Right.
Like?
Yeah. Well, I think the dynamic, there is a dynamic, but I think that it is more in the fact that law firms are kind of flat hierarchies. If you think about it. So I had been used to working, and I'm sure many people, most people, work in an environment where you know who your boss is. Mm-hmm. You know what the expectations are for that person. You probably know your boss's boss. And there's some kind of a ladder, you know, a chain mm-hmm. of authority. What I found in law firms was that every partner had their own little fiefdom.
Yep.
And then you had to learn what that particular partner wanted, what the expectations were, how things worked, all of those things. I felt, to your question, Haley, I felt at an advantage because I had worked before. Yes. So I really do think that for many folks who get out of law school and haven't had what I think of as a real job, that learning how to work is actually one of the biggest learning curves that we have. How to stay on target, how to manage your time, how to manage up, how to manage down. It's a lot of management, not to mention the learning curve of the actual content, the substance of the work that you're doing.
We'll be right back.
Hey guys, we want to take a moment to talk about something that has been a game changer for us busy lawyers, Audible.
Yes, Audible has been our go-to platform for incredible audiobooks, offering an extensive library of thrillers, nonfiction, autobiographies, and mysteries.
And guess what? We've got a special treat for you. Audible is offering a free trial to our listeners, and all you need to do is check the link in the show notes. It's the perfect opportunity to experience the magic of audiobooks without spending a dime.
Speaking of thrillers, I know you are currently hooked on Never Lie by Freda McFadden. Samantha, can you tell us a little bit about it?
Absolutely. The twists and turns in Never Lie have kept me on the edge of my seat during the workday and even when I'm on my daily walks. It's like having a suspenseful companion wherever I go.
And for those looking for some financial wisdom, I have been engrossed in My Money, My Way by Kamuku Love. It's packed with practical advice on managing finances, perfect for anyone trying to navigate the complexities of money management.
What we love most is the flexibility Audible offers. As lawyers, our schedules can be unpredictable, but with Audible, we can enjoy our favorite books on the go, whether we're stuck in traffic, hitting the gym, or waiting for a court hearing.
So, if you're ready to embark on a literary journey and discover the joys of audiobooks, click the link in the show notes to start your free trial with Audible. Trust us, you won't want to miss out on this fantastic offer.
So I wanted, okay, so you left the firm, you started your consulting type work, and then you retired. So what made you want to retire at that point, and what sparked you wanting to come back into litigation?
Well, so the actual circumstances are a little bit humorous because I was in Philadelphia at that time. I was at a big firm, a very big firm. And I really liked it there. And I liked the work that I was doing. I was running, you know, a training business, and I did investigations. I did training. And I felt that I was training on harassment and discrimination. So this is post Anita Hill, you know, this is the big, you know, Farragher Ellerth cases that said you really should have a policy, do training. And so we were training some very big projects, and I liked that. And I, for some reason or another that I don't now remember, I had to take the Pennsylvania bar because I was in Pennsylvania, but I wasn't practicing law at that time. I had moved out of litigation or any kind of practice into this. I had to take the Pennsylvania bar, and I remember that I went up to Boston to this very quiet little island kind of area to study. And the night before I was leaving there to go back and take the bar exam, some neighbors of mine took me out to a local dive, and we were sitting at the bar, and we rode our bicycles there. I had a beach hat on, and a woman sitting next to me said to me, "Oh, you look just like the woman in that Merrill Lynch commercial who's sitting on the beach saying, 'I have enough to retire.'" And this is apparently the way that I make decisions, right? I looked at her and I thought, "Oh, wow. Yeah, I do." Why not? That never occurred to me. And so I went back and I called my husband, and he was in business for himself. And he always used to joke with me and say, "You have to give me 6 months notice." On the days, you know, I don't know if you ever call your friends or loved ones and say, can I quit this? You know, because this is a day in which I'd like to quit this. And they say, "No, not yet." Well, that was my husband. He said, 6 months notice. So I gave 6 months notice, and we moved to Mexico.
Oh, I love that.
So, yeah. So we moved down to San Miguel de Allende, which is in the central highlands of Mexico. And then I didn't really want to be completely retired. And so I became an independent contractor for the firm that I was with. And I continued to do training from 2006 until about 2018. So investigations and training. Then you remember Harvey Weinstein. I'm positive you do. Yeah. Harvey came along with the Me Too movement. I was doing a whole lot of investigations, and I totally by chance ran into a woman who said, "I have this problem. I'm in this Buddhist community, and there's a lot of sexual misconduct." And I was like, "Well, you know, you should tell them, because then they'll, you know, here's my framework is corporate America. Yeah. You tell them, they do an investigation. And, you know, if this is happening, if they find it's happening, they fire the guy, you know." And so she said, "No, they're not speaking to me since I did this." And I remember sitting here right where I am right now. And I thought, "Oh, come on, Carol, you've got an hour or two that you can give her." So I said, I'll look at what you have and see if there is anything that I can do. And fast forward 6 months, the head of the organization, very, very large Buddhist organization in Canada, had left the country. The whole situation had made the front page of the New York Times. And I was besieged by women saying, "This happened to me too. I just didn't have a word for it." I was sexually assaulted in the spiritual community that I was in. So I started on a 4-year pro bono project of investigating these allegations. And on the other part of my time, I was writing, which is a wonderful thing to do when you don't have a job exactly. And I really enjoyed that. I published a book of essays about living in Mexico. I was working on 2 different novels. And in my pro bono work, I found that none of these organizations wanted to change, that they did not care. And I began going around saying, corporate America is doing a better job on sexual misconduct than Buddhist America, or yoga America, or fill in the blank, any religious spiritual community, not just in America, but all over. And so that launched me into a completely different career.
All right. So once you decided to embark on this journey, like you did the 4-year pro bono, what happened then?
Yeah. Well, I ran into a woman, a lawyer, who is an American woman who has her law firm has its offices in London, but she's back and forth to the United States all the time. And she happened to be suing on behalf of a client, a very, very prominent Buddhist leader. And so someone kind of brought that to my attention. I had some information for her, so I contacted her. I really liked her. She's fierce, you know, fierce in a way that I would say to you and your listeners who are younger, that you get with age. You just do. You know, you just get more of an attitude. Or at least more than an attitude than I had when I was much younger. And I liked her, and I said to her, "Will you take this as Anne Olivarius?" I said, "Will you take these cases, Anne? Because we do not have any leverage against these organizations other than the law. We tried media, we tried persuasion, we tried education. I did all kinds of trainings on what the workplace harassment laws are that they ought to be following. We did all of that. But what I found is that I was really dealing with cults. I was not dealing, it's not in the teachings any more than the Catholic Church is in trouble because of the teachings. It's because of the power imbalances in the organizations. And it is because there is a culture that you must obey the teacher no matter what. And if the teacher thinks that you need to have sex with him, because it is usually him, then if you don't think that's a good idea, it's because you are less enlightened than that person is. So this is a very prominent kind of cultural thing in some of the Buddhist and yoga communities, I guess around the world, but I can only really speak to the United States and Canada. And so I didn't have any leverage. I wanted the women that I was working with telling their stories to be able to tell their story and bring change. And I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it with the tools that I had. And so I said to Anne, "Would you take these cases?" And she said, "Yes." And so then I spent a year or so just like consulting with them until about, I guess, 16 months ago, Anne said, "We want you to come on board." And the first thing I said to her is, "Anne, do you have any idea how old I am? You know, we're used to age discrimination in the United States, I think." But it did not bother Anne. And I did come on board. I thought maybe she wanted me to do investigations. She said, just tell me what you'd like to do. I love to do investigations. And so I thought, well, maybe that's what I would do. And so I went to London and I was in the office. And the first day I was there, I said to her, Anne, what do you want me to do? She said, oh, I want you to start up a new practice group on conduct in spiritual, faith-based religious communities. And I'm like, you know, I can't even see litigation in my rearview mirror. And so I can't imagine that this is a good idea. But 16 months later, we have 34 clients, 13 cases, and we are hoping to change the law. Yeah. We have an enormous amount of protection for religions in the United States. Yeah. And if you say that you're a religion, you garner a certain amount of protection, which is good, but it can be used in a negative way as well.
Absolutely.
So are you seeing, I guess, because what interested me, the whole reason we reached out to you is because we had a conversation with, you know, a long time ago about cults, because we were watching the documentaries and we were like, oh my gosh, like, what can we do? Like, you know, there's got to be a way around this, like, to help these people that are vulnerable. And, you know, there's just so many circumstances of how people get involved, right? So are cults mostly saying that they're a religion?
We have one is saying you can't tell me what to do because I'm a religion, but that is not true. Mm-hmm. That is not the First Amendment. The First Amendment protects beliefs. So where we walk a line from a legal perspective is making sure that we are not challenging someone's beliefs. So, you know, we might like to say, I'll just give you a kind of an example. We have a client who says, it was psychological coercion because this person told me, well, you have to do this with me in order to become enlightened. So that was psychological coercion. That was really fraud. Well, you can't really litigate that under the First Amendment because it requires a judge to decide whether the person really might not become enlightened, which of course a judge does not want to do. However, what people do, their conduct, is not protected by the First Amendment. So you've listened to these cult documentaries and you've thought about it, so you know that the law does not give us many tools to go after cults. There's religion, and then there's the issue of undue influence. Mm-hmm. Psychological coercion, consent, our ideas about consent are evolving. And so there's a limited amount of leverage that we have legally. So what we've been doing, what we've found is that while you cannot necessarily have a lot of ways to sue a cult for emotional damage, mm-hmm. or for financial damage, because they're very coercive, generally speaking, financially. There are laws that help us for sexual assault. So again, it's not the belief. Everyone is entitled to believe what they want. And if you believe that you can murder somebody because that's in your religion, you're entitled to believe it, but the conduct is not protected.
Yes.
Okay, so makes sense. Yeah. So we're using the human trafficking laws to try to, we are trying to use the tools that we can find in the law and use them in new ways. And it kind of takes me back to Harvey Weinstein, because the human trafficking, the TVPA, the federal law was used against him. So because it fits. It's fraud, coercion. You know, Harvey's thing was, you know, I'll get you an interview with a big producer. You'll have sex with me. And so there are ways, but there aren't enough ways.
Do you think that now that there's, you know, a ton of documentaries and all this kind of stuff about cults, that people are speaking out more? Like, do you find that in your practice that you have, you know, are more people coming out and saying, like, this happened to me and I want to do something about it? Maybe they didn't know that there was even recourse before.
Yes, absolutely. I think it's all good in the sense that, yes, we need to recognize what the kind of markers are of coercive behavior. And I think one of the big barriers for us, quite frankly, are statutes of limitations. What we know and what we're seeing in states, and if there are listeners out there who say, what can I do? It's to advocate for longer statutes of limitation for sexual assault victims. Because what we're seeing is, you think about this, if you're a minor, seeing extended periods of time for the statutes of limitations, that's changing. But as soon as you turn 18, you're supposed to be able to process this, you know, in a very short period of time. It doesn't happen. We know from brain science that it doesn't happen. We need people to have longer periods of time, longer statutes of limitations. Canada has no statute of limitations on sexual assault. And we need something like that, at least longer periods for people. Because these, when you're in a spiritual community, it's somebody that you trust.
Yeah.
And processing that kind of assault from someone that you trusted and is your community takes a very long time for most people.
Yeah.
And when you say advocating for longer statute of limitations, like, what does that look like? You know, does that mean like writing to your senator or, you know, like,
sure.
Is that, yes. What are some steps that people can take?
Yeah, absolutely. The legislators in all of these states have the power to enlarge the statute of limitations. So just for an example, New York State, when they enlarged the statute of limitations, did two what I call open windows, revival windows.
Yeah,
California has done the same thing. So what they've done is they've said, okay, no statute of limitation. We're in 1 year for old claims to come forward. And many, many people did. They did that for children, and then they did it for adults over the age of 18. California has an open window now. The city of New York has the Gender Motivated Violence Act, and that is open for another year. And we're seeing people who, of course, left these cults in the, let's say, 80s. You know, the 60s and 70s were great years for people coming from the East and bringing a new philosophy, all of which had very positive benefits, but it also had negative things associated with it as well. And now we're seeing people who thought, well, the statute of limitations has been over for years and years and years. There's no chance for me. So that's one thing to advocate for, is an open window.
Mm-hmm.
Change the statute of limitations for longer. Write your legislator. Write to me. And, you know, I'll find out in your state who you could contact. But that's what we really need, is for people to have an opportunity to tell their stories. It's healing. You know, it's not just about money, because we're working in the civil justice system. So all there is monetary. Although sometimes most of my clients want the organizations that they were a part of to change. They want to ask for change. But it's not just money. It's healing and having people who previously denied you, silenced you, gaslit you, be able to now listen to your story because they're forced to.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you're doing some amazing work and we are so impressed. And I'm automatically thinking, okay, we need a window. You know, I was thinking immediately when you brought that up about New York, I didn't even know California had one. You know, every state should have one.
Yes. Every state should have a long enough statute of limitations for, and they can only be on the civil side. We can't deprive people of their due process rights on the criminal side, right? But Vermont has done a change in the statute of limitations. I think all of the Supreme Courts of the states that I'm aware of have found that these can be retroactive and can apply. The Vermont Supreme Court certainly just did this past summer. So those are the kinds of things that people can do. And I think that when persuasion doesn't, this is the wonderful thing. Let's go back to being a lawyer. It's a wonderful tool for change.
Yeah,
it is. It's a wonderful tool for change. And it is, you know, as I told you, I went to law school when I was 40, and I have many days been unhappy in my career in the law, but I have never regretted. I have never regretted doing it because, I mean, if you just look at my career, it was the standard kind of large firm practice. Then I did training and investigations. Then I just went out and did training as an independent contractor. And now I'm back litigating again. There's a lot of room in the law for change in a lot of areas. And heaven knows the world that all of you are inheriting needs change of all kinds.
So if we have a listener who wants to reach out to you and talk about your practice, or, you know, maybe they have a case of their own, you know, how can they reach out to you?
You can email me. So C Murchison. So MERCHASIN @ M like Mary, C like Carol, O like Oliver, law.com. So Carol, C Murchison @ mcolaw.com. I would love to hear from any of your listeners who want to talk about how to make a career change, even.
Absolutely.
We're always interested in talking with people who may want alternative remote work, for example, who want We work as a team, so it's a very different kind of environment than I was describing in my early career.
Yeah.
And we're doing some creative work, and I think it's quite satisfying for people in their careers to have that opportunity to do that. So yes, reach out to me. And if you know of someone who wants to talk about it, I talk to one or two people a week that may or may not have a legal case, but I think just people need to have their stories told.
Oh, so beautiful. Thank you so much, Carol. We appreciate you coming on the show and sharing your amazing story and amazing work.
Thank you for what you are doing. I love Ladies Who Law. I said it's the best podcast title I've ever heard, I think. And for what you're doing in helping people, again, hear their stories, tell their stories about being lawyers. It's not easy work. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, guys. I mean, Carol, she's just a superstar. Not only is she doing amazing freaking work, but she's so sweet, cute, and fun. Like, I just want to hang out with her. I want to go visit her in Mexico, and I hope my life can be as exciting as hers when I am post-retirement from being a lawyer, right? What do you think, Samantha?
Yeah, I thought it was amazing how she was able to, you know, retire, but then found the passion again to go back and do something that she's always wanted to do. It's, you know, as much as it is a job to her, it probably is a passion project as well, just because she is so passionate about it, you know. And I'm sure it doesn't necessarily feel like work, you know. So I think it was a great episode. I'm so glad that you guys got to hear from her. And if you guys have any more questions, or if you know anyone who might want to chat with Carol, definitely reach out. Her information is going to be in the show notes.
Yes, ma'am. And if you ever have any recommendations on guests, this was a listener recommended guest. So just let us know, people out there. I know it was so funny. We were watching some Netflix show about cults and we were just chatting about it randomly in the end of one of our podcasts, and you guys totally pulled through. So we really appreciate that. Meeting Carol was a highlight, and we hope that you guys will chat with her too, especially if you have some kind of tie, or, you know, maybe you're interested in cult litigation too.
So if you want to know more about episodes that we'll be posting this year, make sure to follow us at the Ladies Who Law Podcast on Instagram. We're always posting what new episodes are coming out and some more fun stuff. And of course, check out our website. We have select items of merch that are our favorites right now that are out. So take a look at those at ladieswholawschool.com.
Yes. And
As always, the biggest compliment you can pay us is recommending our podcast to a friend, a fellow lady lawyer, or someone out there who wants to potentially go to law school, right? Also, subscribe wherever you listen, and we love you guys so much. We hope that you had a great week, and we will talk to you again next week. Bye, y'all.
Bye.